Hey guys, I need you to listen to me before we get started. This is not an advertisement. This isn't a plug. This is what's going on. There's some sort of audio quality issue that is occurring. I thought that it was isolated to the last show. I thought that it was isolated to the microphones that I used on that show. I'm now using a different microphone and the problem is still there. I hear it, you know, a couple of seconds into the intro. You'll hear it too. just know that I'm working on it. I'm trying to get these episodes out as fast as I can to you. So that's why we're going to stick with the schedule and get these out every 2 weeks as opposed to me trying to fix it. And then, you know, and there's a lot going on. You'll hear about it in the intro. But for now, I appreciate your patience while I try and figure out what the deal is with this little distortion element that comes and goes. All right. So I appreciate it. And on with the show. Everybody, welcome back to Classical Guitar Insider. This is your host, Brett Williams, and today on the show, we have Herschel Garfine, the Grammy Award-winning pianist and composer, visits me in Brooklyn. He currently lives in Park Slope, so he's just down the road there, and he was kind enough to grace us with his presence. So that in a minute, but first, the show is sponsored by audibletrial.com/insider. You guys have been going to audibletrial.com/insider, and you guys have been getting your free audiobook downloads and your 30-day free trials, and I have been reaping the financial benefits of that. So thank you for visiting them. And furthermore, between you and me, thank you for taking the extra time that audible.com has required to enter audibletrial.com/insider. I don't know. Your guess is as good as mine as to why they require that instead of just having like a code at checkout. Maybe they do have a code at checkout and I just didn't do my research. But from what I understand, there's two websites. There's audible.com and there's audibletrial.com. And I consider myself in direct competition with audible.com. Audibletrial.com is the person that's sponsoring me. So if you go to audible.com, you're going to the wrong people. All right, how's that, Audible? You want to play games? I can hit back. Yeah, stupid, isn't it? Why is everybody trying to pull one over on everybody else? No offense, audibletrial.com is incredible. You can listen to almost anything with the most beautiful voices right there, whispering sweetly into your ear. Oh, the show is also sponsored by SavageClassical.com. SavageClassical.com. I just sent my guitar student there. We're looking at a couple of guitars. She's getting her eyes. She's eyeing a little Kenny Hill there. Little piece by Kenny Hill for $1,500. If you want to go higher, you can. Guitars start at about $500. And then he's got some electric guitars there now, too. Don't be offended. They're high end. Limited quantities. That's SavageClassical.com. No slash insider there. That's a direct sponsorship from the best guitar dealer in the known universe. SavageClassical.com. Tell them Big Diaper Brett sent you. All right, so I'm I'm coming to you from my bedroom right now. Well, what was my bedroom? My landlord is in between fixing up the balcony roof, which almost caved in on top of me due to the snow and the bad weather, and due to the fact that it's just a balcony, and balconies in New York are falling at an alarmingly higher rate. So my life has been saved by my landlord, and he is being kind enough to work on that with his buddy today. So there might be a little bit of hammers and nails in the background. Anyway, I'm in the bedroom right now of what used to be my apartment. And you're right. You got it. You guessed it. I moved out. I moved to Greenpoint, Brooklyn. Beautiful Greenpoint, Brooklyn, where English is 50% of the languages that are spoken and 20 to 30% of the population speaks Polish. It's amazing. I've never lived in a European immigrant neighborhood that is this this serious. You know, when I lived in the East Village, you could say that was Ukrainian, but you know, not really. You would see those guys once in a while. I am the ethnic minority in my neighborhood, and it's pretty cool. It's pretty neat. It's a neat neighborhood with a lot of history. Some of that history is bad. Some of it has to do with an oil spill that was in 1950 that supposedly was three times the size of the Exxon Valdez. So there's that. And my friend kind of ruined it for me because I was really stoked on it. It's got all this old architecture. It looks like an old movie set from the, you know, 50s going down there on Manhattan Avenue. I mean, yeah, sure. You look to the left, you look to the right, you see a Payless and a bank. But if you look up a little bit, you see all this old, old New York architecture. And it's just, it's really, I think it's very breathtaking. But I was talking to my friend Rob yesterday, and he's like, you know, he's like, well, I'm really sorry about the breakup. But you got to move out of Greenpoint. You know, there was an oil spill there, and it's also where they used to send all of the city's trash. So you're on a mountain of trash and oil, and that can't be good for you. And so I looked it up, and you know, some people are on one side of it, some people are on the other. I'm sure the oil companies are just covering it up. Supposedly Exxon throws a party in the park every year for Earth Day. Because they were the ones responsible for the oil spill. I love that. Earth Day in Greenpoint is sponsored by ExxonMobil. Oh, my God. Yeah. So, yeah, that's what happened. That's the deal. Wendy is staying in this apartment. I'm helping her out and sitting around and doing the editing the podcast. I left my microphones over here, so it's good. Still going to do the podcast out of the thing. She's being great about the breakup. So she's, you know, we're both being great. We're both trying to do it in a way that's respectful and loving. And we want to remain close, but we just are not able to make it work as a couple at this time. Is it sad? Sure. But it's also, it could be an exciting new chapter in my life. And it's going to make for good fodder for the show, right? I haven't been single in 15 years, folks. I have no idea what's going to happen. I don't know how to hit on a woman. My friend told me I need to go on Tinder. All right. Now, from what I understand, Tinder is just for sex. Is that what it is? Because I don't know what the, I'm scared of that. Swiping left, swiping right. Not knowing what you're going to end up in. Sitting there waiting for somebody that doesn't show up, you know, ready to crap your pants. That doesn't sound like fun to me. What I'm not into is dating. You know, you see somebody and you kind of like them, but you kind of want to make it work because you're kind of lonely and you're all, you know, ready to go. But you, so you kind of try and make it work with a person that isn't suitable for you. I don't know. That's the way I see it. I don't see it as, not excited about that. I'm an outgoing guy, and once I get started, I'm fine with talking to girls, but I don't know how to initiate a conversation, particularly with someone beautiful and young, which is, you know, a large part of the population in New York that I'll be talking to in these next couple of months. But I got a roommate. He may or may not have pink eye. We don't know. He puts potatoes on his face. I know that. So my room is pretty big over there. It looks at a Kentucky Fried Chicken and a Taco Bell and a construction site. And actually, I looked at the construction site. They're to the point where they're doing the foundation. They're digging. And I can definitely see oil in that dirt. That dirt is black. It's a lot blacker than than the orange dirt that I've seen in other construction sites. I've seen my fair share of construction being a New Yorker on his 14th year in the city. Right? 14? Yeah. Yeah, so actually Wendy and I were together for almost 16 years. Oh, Jesus. You know, what kind of a girl is going to want to date that? You know, that's the thing. I don't know. Now we're talking about what we need to do as far as our Facebook stuff is. You know, it's like you got to break up, then you got to go to the Facebook, and then it's like, I got, like, we're arguing about whether or not it's time to do that or whether we're ready to tell her because, oh, well, once you do that, then everybody knows. And then everybody's like, oh, my God, I'm so sorry. And you're like, it's okay. We've been dealing with this with our close friends for, you know, 6 months. and we're still, you know, we're still making this work. And then, you know, you just kind of like, it's like, that's a whole new level. So there's like all these new ways that you got to, when you break up, you got to like, you got to move out, which that sucks because I just moved in August. So now I'm moving again and building IKEA furniture again and stuff like that. But as far as like splitting everything up, we're both just like, what do you want? What do you want? Like, we just want we want happiness for the other person. And that's what's making this so great of a breakup. It's so unique. We were at one time the best couple, and now we're having the best breakup. You know, there's reasons for it. No one was cheating or anything like that. It's just, you're out there and you're out at night or something, and you realize that you can connect with everybody else in the room a little bit better than the one you're supposed to be connecting with the most. And that happens too often, and it happens for a couple of years. And I'm going to go out on a limb and say most people just stick with it until it blows up in their face and they hate each other. And that's not me. I am a proactive person. And so I'm moving out. Moving out. One girl did come up to me at the bar. She smelled like cigarettes, and she said, does your phone work? And I said, no, it's not. I'm getting bad reception. She goes, well, it's your lucky day because I can't get on Tinder. I don't think so. She smelled like poison. I mean, just like garlic and cigarettes and just like everything you're not supposed to eat if you plan on talking to, someone you're going to try and hook up with. So she was breaking all the rules as far as I was concerned. But I got to get used to that. You know, other people's breath. What a mess. 39 and single? I don't know. I'm sure that there are some of you out there that are like, big deal. I look younger. I probably, I can pull off about 33, 34. You know, I can remember how I felt when I was that age. I feel like I'm kind of the same. I got dystonia when I was 34, 35. So, that's kind of how I'm marking this common era. So, I feel like I'm still in that place, and I can connect with those people. I don't know about dating anybody in their early 20s. I think that's out for me. It's just too big of a leap. They're not in the place I need them to be in. You know, maybe like a little bit of a snuggling and stuff like that, but no serious dating. So I don't know. Two or three of you guys actually sent me people. I appreciate it, but forget about it. I'm going to hook up with the friends of my listeners. But Tinder. So is that what you do? Do you do Tinder? I thought that my brother did that, and he ended up hanging out with a girl. She had him feel a divot in her head. She had like a hole in her head. And he was like, I'm out. That's it. I don't want to deal with that. I don't want to. My problem is I get so easily irritated by people. That if I was in a situation, and I get very easily irritated, and I also want everybody to like me, which is a poisonous situation for a Tinder candidate, because in that situation, you go on this date, and I still feel like I'm just young enough to still do Tinder, but you go on a date, kind of. All right, let me tell the older listeners what's going on here. This is what Tinder is. All right, what Tinder is it's an app on your phone, and it has people in your area, and you get a slider, and you can select an age range. So like my age range would probably be something like 27 to 43. That would be my age range, right? That's the age range that I would set, I think. I don't know. I'll have to take a look at it. I know the right thing would be 30 to 55. I don't know. I still think I can connect with someone in their 20s as long as they have, you know, lived a little bit of life, had a little bit of hurt, and that they aren't too rich, then I think it'll be fine. That's my other problem, is I don't get along with really rich people that well. And that's something I might want to change. Because I am utterly broke. You guys need to donate to the show now before I have to move to Alabama, because I cannot run this show from Stockton, California. There's just not enough people coming through. There's no way. So you got to donate to the show. Go to BrettWilliamsMusic.com. Hit the donate button on the right when you go to the podcast section and donate as much as you can. All right, let's make a little pledge drive. Let's get this going. Because I'm super broke, guys. Super broke. This is so expensive. I just spent a lot of money moving here. And now I spent a lot of money moving out. And, you know, now I'm paying everything on my own. So I really need your help. All right, not to beg, but forget about this show being on. It's just not going to happen. I can't do it. I'll tell you what's going on. I got to go out. I'm getting my real estate license. Now, why? Because I can't make it work as a musician. I don't know why. I think my album is outstanding. I think my body of work is outstanding. I think my ability to give a powerful performance is outstanding. And yet, the classical guitar world is set in its ways, and it's not about to let in a composer guitarist who is doing something new that is not academic. I just think they're not ready for it. I think that they're old school. I think if anything, I got a shot with the chamber music world. But you know, that's a tough one to, I'm starting there from ground zero. Back in the duo days, I had a little bit of traction, but that's who I have to approach, because the guitar people, first of all, I'm a new guy and they're not going to put the kind of budget money that they need to put into a new guy who's going to require the kind of fee that I'm going to require, because I have a quartet to pay. So that's, and if I need to travel or something like that, I can't, you know, if you're by yourself, I mean, I get it. The thing is that I would be part of, like, for in the New York Guitar Society, I would be part of the Salon Series. Now, why can't John put me in the Salon Series? Because the Salon Series is probably, you know, maximum $500 for the Salon Series. And I don't know. I haven't talked to him about it, but, or maybe he's planning me for next year or something like that. But that's where you put like an emerging artist. You put him in the Salon Series. But there's four of us, and each one of my guys is going to want, you know, $200, $300 minimum. And I'm going to want double that for the work that I'm going to put into it. Now, what do you say? You say, oh, should I charge? I'd play that thing for free. Just so you know, guys, I mean, that's the thing. If you're in the tri-state area, we'll do it cheap if you're a guitar society. Listen to me, selling my soul. So my friend Rob, the same guy who told me that Greenpoint was a poisonous cesspool, is now working. He works for Kaplan, and he's trying to get me a 50% discount on a course for real estate. I think I could do some good stuff with real estate, but I think, again, it would be a headache. It's going to be breaking in. You got to study for this thing. It's like a 74-hour course. I don't know. It seems kind of complicated. And I have virtually zero passion for it. So that's the tough thing, is like, you know, when you're doing this, same thing with the copywriting and the advertising stuff I do. It's like I have the ability, but I don't, the passion's not there. And I've got just enough money with the teaching where it's hard to really generate the fire at this point in the year. I don't know. It's a tough thing. Anyway, I don't know why we're going into this. I'll talk more to you. This has been a long intro. I just needed to fill you guys in on a lot of stuff. I am doing fine. I appreciate all your emails and all your love, and please donate to the show. All right. Enough's enough. Let's start making some money at this. The sponsors are doing their part. I need you guys to do yours. Let's get on with the show. Here's composer and librettist, Grammy Award-winning dude, Herschel Garfine. Garfine?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's not Garfine.
No.
And in fact, what happens when people say that?
Oh, well, I mean, my first name... my first name is Herschel, so I have... There's so many possible mishaps in saying my name, I'm totally used to it.
It's a name that I've never seen.
Herschel, yeah.
No.
Oh, Garfine.
The whole thing.
The whole thing, yeah.
But you don't, I mean, I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know if you were going to have an accent or...
Yeah, or like a black hat and payas.
No.
Given that it's Williamsburg. Jewish name.
Where do you live?
I live in Park Slope.
Oh, okay. And yeah. Are you from New York originally?
From New York originally, but I spent a long, long time in Boston.
Garfang.
Garfine. Now that you've asked, you're never going to get it right.
Garfine.
Like, fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's the Bernstein people have big issues with.
And
that.
In fact,
they get pissed.
My wife has that last name. She she uses her
and she says Steen.
And she says Steen. Right?
Okay.
So, and I'm always making fun of her for it.
And what about, is it James Levine or James Levine? I always forget that too.
He chooses to call himself Levine.
You know, when you're a kid and you're like in Tower Records and you're buying those CDs for the first time in your life.
Yeah.
You call him whatever you want. You have no point. There's nobody saying James Levine
right.
in Stockton, California.
And then some snob, you know, turns their nose up at you.
But it's Levine. It's always Ean.
It should be. But he says Levine.
But not with you.
Well, that's E-I-N. It's different. It's like...
Okay.
Geez. So as
it's all German.
Yeah. We're getting into like bottom of the barrel jokes around my house. But like, for example... delight of my kids,
Garfine.
For the delight of my kids, sometimes my wife and I have this mock argument about how our names should be correctly pronounced, and I say, just think of the great scientist Albert Einstein, right?
Uh huh.
Nobody says that,
so right?
That's my point.
They never do, right?
Yeah.
So I say,
Ein is correct. EI is supposed to be I in all Germanic languages,
and then you start throwing dishes, and if I was like Einstein, or if you know.
And we speculate also that...
If things were different...
Is this okay if we never get to music on this? Is that
absolutely.
Okay?
All right. 100%.
Like just etymology of names and things. We also speculate that my wife and I could never have done hyphenated last names for our kids. Because there would be three ways to say it wrong.
Too much.
And only one way to say it right.
Yeah, I wouldn't have liked that.
Yeah,
as a teacher, getting that kid.
Yeah.
Bernstein Garfine.
Yeah. Or is it Bernstein Garfine? Or is it Bernstein Garfine? Or is it Bernstein Garfine?
Well, we should know it.
It's all wrong.
We should all get into it. Okay, so the thing is, what we were talking about is New Voices, which is, this is your latest CD. This is what the one with the unicorn song on it, right?
That's right.
That's a good song.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
You're a good songwriter. And one of the things that I think is really interesting is you are the first award-winning librettist to ever grace our show.
Oh.
Not only that, but you're not a guitar composer.
No.
Which is what I'm trying to do. We're trying to get this. And we have 70 episodes in, so now we're trying to expose our audience to things other than guitar, which they should be into anyway.
Right.
So, but as far as librettist, that to me was one of the most exciting things about having you on, was that we are people that generally, even as a composer, nowhere near your ilk, but as a composer at all, I have a very big fear of writing music with words.
Right.
I'm afraid that my songs will sound
right.
stupid, that they'll. Right. I get self-conscious. And a lot of times when I listen to other people's lyrics, I'm like, oh, that's silly.
Right.
You know, like even if you listen to the best guys like Simon and Garfunkel out there, you still are just like, no, that's kind of a silly lyric. You know what I mean? Like
There can be.
Silly things are being said right now.
Well, I think for a lot of us who are musicians, writing words is what we've always tried to avoid doing. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. There's a certain kind of non-literalness to music that I think we all embrace. And I certainly in my early attempts at writing, I found it far too explicit. I found it like, oh, that's embarrassing. And it always would come out wrong.
Yeah, embarrassment is the big issue.
Yeah, and it would almost never come out right. You know. Whereas with music, it seems like because of its inherently abstract quality or whatever, you don't often write silly things unless you're trying to, I suppose. So I hear what you're saying. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you experienced that.
Yeah.
You experienced that self-consciousness when you started writing lyrics.
A little bit. It's kind of a little odd in my case. There would sort of have to be an unusual reason for doing, you know, really I do lyrics and I do music almost equally. Not exactly by choice. I would prefer to do more music and fewer lyrics, but I tend to get paid for the lyrics because exactly what you say, a lot of people can't do it. A lot of composers need them and can't really write them themselves, right? But anyway, I actually came to music fairly late. And when I was growing up, I always wanted to be a writer.
Right.
And then I really seized on music at a certain point and loved exactly what I was saying before, that kind of the non-literal aspect of it. And I only came back to writing much, much later. Kind of out of desperation, when I first got out of conservatory, I went to New England Conservatory in Boston for grad school. When I first got out of there, I very early on connected with the choreographer Mark Morris, you know, and who wasn't Mark Morris at the time. He was just Mark
guy.
Morris. Yeah.
Just a dude.
Yeah. and we worked together very early on, really, in both of our careers. And I did a big piece for him called Mythologies, which was a big evening-long dance piece.
Right. That's what I read about. Yeah, I was like, oh, that's cool. That's neat. So you actually did... Okay, so I mean, yeah.
Well,
go on.
So it was a commission. I mean, it was a commission to write an evening long dance piece based on essays by this great, kind of crazy but really wonderful French writer named Roland Barthes, great essayist, not a fiction writer, but like a very, very brainy but brilliant French. He called himself a semiologist. He studied the science of signs, what signs
mean. I've heard of semiology once. Yeah. I must have just looked it up.
It's become pretty, it's a pretty hip
science.
Thing now.
Yeah, science. It's right. Pretty what hip. What are the signs, man?
Yeah. science everywhere.
Exactly.
So anyway, I was doing this evening length piece, and I was doing these three pieces that made up the evening could all be for different kinds of instrumentation. And the big culminating one, which was called Soap, Powders, and Detergents. I'll get back to that in a second. based on this essay of his.
Yeah, because your lyrics, yeah, like you said, I mean, one of the defining characteristics of your lyrics is the vernacular, the simplicity.
Well, I appreciate
not
that.
Simplicity
it's extremely
in a bad
important to
right.
me. Extremely important.
I understand me. What's being said, and it's done in simple
right.
language.
And I hate, well, the one thing I hate above all else in...
Not to interrupt.
In class, no, that's cool. That's exactly what I would get to. In classical music, I guess the thing that I hate most of all in sung music, classical music, is its grandiosity. I just can't stand that. The fact that it's a kind of a shakedown of the audience, you know.
Right.
You deal with grand things and you present them grandly, and nobody, you know, nobody's supposed to say, hey, you know what, that's a load of crap.
Right.
You know, because it's robed in such... pretension and all that. Anyway.
Right. Everybody's dressed like a god. So
yeah, exactly. And they're standing
there
with their hand, you know, just so in the crook of the piano, and they're wearing a great evening gown, and, you know, and everybody has to be quiet.
And we all have to pretend like we understand French poetry.
Or else you're an idiot. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So I was writing
back to French poetry.
So speaking of French. So I was writing
semiology.
I was writing this piece called Soap, Powders, and Detergents. And at a certain point, I realized, oh my God, this needs to be a cantata. It needs to have some chorus in it and some soloists, and I don't have any words, and the deadline is a month away for the whole thing. And so I had no choice but to write the words myself.
Is the cantata from the... What's the difference between a cantata and an oratorio?
An oratorio tends to be longer, but it's in the same...
And the cantata is it based on religious text, basically?
It can be. Like Bach would write
Bach
one every
cantatas,
Sunday.
Right.
Yeah,
okay, so
he'd write
Bach,
one every
right,
Sunday.
Yeah, exactly.
But he wrote a few secular ones, too, like the Coffee Cantata, which is a great
And
piece.
An oratorio is one that is like before that or something.
No, oratorio is sort of like... It's sort of like the buttoned-up version of opera. It had to be on like a religious subject or, you know... some kind of a worthy subject, mythological or that sort of thing. And
so you made the decision to do this in the form of a cantata.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I was very influenced by the Coffee Cantatas, given that this piece was supposed to be about by Bach. He wrote this great cantata in which he used...
I don't know about this.
Yeah, it's
Go
cool.
Ahead.
And it's really good music, but he took the form of a cantata and he just applied it to a very, very little, you know, fun little story that he made up himself about a girl who wants to get married, but she drinks too much coffee, or her father drinks too much coffee. I can't actually remember right now.
Oh, so
and
he
it's
got
all about
cute
that.
For like a second.
Oh, yeah, totally.
For like
it's actually
one
funny.
Of the
it's really, it's
2,
very sweet.
2,000 cantatas are about coffee.
Right, it's not about the nails in Christ's flesh. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay, so that was it. I was in desperation a month from deadline. I had no lyrics.
It's your first gig out of school, too.
It was pretty soon after school. Yeah, pretty
first
soon.
First big one. Yeah.
It was definitely the first big one. Mm-hmm. And so I just said, okay, I'm going to just go for it and write these lyrics myself. And then on from there, then I was, you know, I adapted some things. I guess the thing that I'm probably best known for as a writer at this point, the thing I won the Grammy for, right, is Elmer Gantry, an opera that I wrote with a dear friend of mine, Bob Aldridge, was the composer. But he and I were colleagues and good friends. And even then, you know, it was fairly on in my, for fairly early on in my career as a writer, I was, at that point, I was better known as a composer. And he turned to me for the libretto to this opera, which was another huge challenge. I had never undertaken anything nearly so.
Yeah,
so
just big. So people are clear, this is not the same situation. The first one is the dance piece.
Yeah, yeah.
Called,
sorry.
No, don't be sorry. But yeah, that's the Grammy is for that. Is a librettist.
Right. That's when I guess you could call me an actual librettist, when I wrote the book for an opera. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, we'll definitely get to that because that's a huge deal. And cool. It's Aldridge.
Bob Aldridge. Bob is the Aldridge. Composer. Yeah, Robert.
And
Aldridge.
Is right. But you are a composer.
I am a composer.
But
yeah,
the
I know it gets confusing.
The Grammys
even I get
for
confused.
Libretta.
Well, no, because it in the one special case of when an opera wins for best contemporary classical composition,
which is what you won.
When it, and it's very rarely been an opera. But I mean, only a few times has it ever been an opera.
Yeah, I bet it would be most vocal. There's two other categories over which you could vote for that.
Well, there's best opera. There's best opera
right.
recording.
Right.
But that usually actually doesn't go to the creators. First of all, because new operas almost never win it.
Right.
But that goes to all the people on the cast.
Right.
And the conductor and all that sort of thing.
Right.
So it's more like the total recorded package of an opera wins that. But we won for the best contemporary classical composition, which could be anything. Operas are entered, but symphonies are entered, and chamber music is entered. Anything
so that's
within
important.
The classical realm. Yeah, and it just so happens that the rule is that if an opera wins that, then the librettist gets a Grammy as well as the composer.
Sweet.
Yeah. I think so.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah.
But going back to the piece, to the dance piece.
Yeah.
What is it like collaborating? I mean, this was because you're talking about this being an initial collaboration.
Yeah.
I mean, with this guy, but was his text written before you said it?
Well, choreographer. I mean, was his? No, he didn't do anything until
choreographer.
I, yeah.
Sorry,
no, he didn't do anything until.
What do you call it?
Dance.
Blocking. Choreography.
Oh, it's choreography. No,
choreography.
No.
So you guys got together and he's like, let's just do something new?
Yeah, I mean, you know Mark's work, or do you know him as...
I don't know anything about okay. dance. I feel bad about it. I really need to do
well,
it.
Well, I mean, he's at this point...
Do you know
point,
a lot about dance?
Yeah, I guess I used
now
to.
Yeah, oh, you did for a bit.
It's been right. a while. I haven't written for dance in a long time.
Well, give me a check. I'll care about anything. But so dance, I do actually, but I really do. I mean, I've never been to the ballet.
Well,
I'm like very, very
yeah.
bad about this.
Okay, well, I hate to put this in kind of august terms, but he has to be the greatest living choreographer. But
I'm such
Mark
an
Morris.
Idiot. What's it, Mark That's Morris?
A, yeah. Yeah.
See that? Why don't I know
and
that?
And he has his own school and studio right over near BAM, and he does, every year at BAM, he does his own version of the Nutcracker called the Hard Nut.
Nah.
Yeah, and you know he's always irreverent.
Wait, I heard my girlfriend went to that. She said it was amazing.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's it. That's the one.
Okay.
Yeah.
The Hard Nut.
Yeah.
All right. Go ahead.
And he's incredibly musical.
Mark Morris.
Yeah. Now he actually does some conducting on his own. You know, he's that good. But his responsiveness as a choreographer to music was always amazing. So.
Awesome.
So he, I guess the easiest way to say it is we trusted each other on this. It was not our first time working together. We first worked together at a summer program. That's where we met. We did a piece there, and it was very, you know, it was a lot of fun. It was very kind of balls to the wall writing. I would write something every night, and there'd be this little ensemble there that would play it, and he would choreograph it on the fly and that kind of stuff. And but when it came time for Mythologies, he just sort of said he loved the idea. I brought him the idea of setting these Roland Barthes essays. He loved that. He said, go off and do it, and you know, bring it back to me, and I did, and then he choreographed.
How did you guys meet? How do artists of different mediums, if you don't mind me asking, what year was this?
So this was
90s?
No. 83?
Okay, so you're still in the throes
yeah,
of
were you
old
born?
77.
Okay.
You're still in the throes
you
of
You were in kindergarten.
I was The first thing I remember is Superman 2. That's what I remember.
So you weren't aware of Mark Morris when you were in kindergarten?
I remember Reagan getting shot, and I remember Superman 2.
Okay.
That's all right, I remember all right. from that era. All
right.
But as far as that time, though, that is still... That's pre-Giuliani New York. You know, it's very gritty. Soho is still, you could afford an apartment.
Right, and
there.
we did one of these pieces.
83.
Yeah, we did one of these pieces.
Well, why do you look so young? You don't look that much older than me.
Just luck. Poverty. I think poverty keeps me young.
Poverty keeps us young.
Yeah, right.
Dude,
on.
100%.
Let's shake hands. They can't see it, but let's shake hands on it. Yeah.
I 100% agree with that.
Yeah.
Because I think it keeps your brain going like, you gotta keep going.
Because you're hungry. Yeah, you gotta keep that, like, the adrenaline and all that.
People think I'm probably about 6 or 7 years younger than I am.
Yeah.
Because I'm about to be 39 on Friday.
Yeah.
And so, but I look a little bit younger.
You do.
And you definitely look 15 years younger.
Good.
If this is what I'm thinking.
Yeah. I'm glad. Yeah,
I mean, it's amazing.
I go
you're
to those...
87 years old, and you look like you're 42.
And what I do, the major way I capitalize it is whenever I go to amusement parks. You know, they always have that thing like if they can guess your age within five years, they give you $5.
Oh, wow! I never heard of that.
Like, it's right next door to the big mallet. You have to hit the gong.
And
with.
They
I
always
can't do
get
that.
You wrong.
Yeah, they always get me wrong.
Yeah,
yeah.
It is. It has to be poverty.
And you have to prove it. Yeah, it is. It's poverty. It's totally poverty.
No, so poverty. In your situation, does your wife do music too?
No, she's a civilian.
Okay, she's
a civilian. She has a real job.
Yeah, my girl works at Food Network, so it's why.
Right. Like, that's why we're here, man.
I like the. I don't know where I'd be. I'd be with some 23-year-olds in a...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, in an
astro. I was having some trouble with the girl a while, and I looked into other apartments, and I was like, this one apartment smelled like feet and pot.
Right.
And the room was 7 feet by 12 feet.
Right.
And there was a couple living right across the hall.
And I'd be in that apartment, but in Grand Rapids. Like, not even in New York, man.
Is that where you're from, is Grand Rapids?
It just came to me.
You just have to.
It just came to
just
me.
Have to. It's a digital age, man. We can live anywhere. But as far as, what were we talking about? You,
feet?
Poverty.
Feet. Poverty. Poverty. Oh,
all,
yeah. Okay.
All the
so,
things that make up
oh,
successful
so,
podcast.
Oh, how Brooklyn had changed.
Oh,
how
no.
Brooklyn.
How, was that Brooklyn in 83?
Well, we did. I was going to say we were on the second year.
Because I didn't think
there
was a Brooklyn in 83.
Well, we did part of this. The three pieces that comprise mythology, each mythology.
I'm sorry about the hands. I got to ask for the hands.
The hands make tactics.
Because I have the cheapest stuff in the world. Poverty.
Poverty.
I want to stay young.
There it is again. It's a theme.
Otherwise, we'd have the things with the arms and the hanging
over. Are people
going to
follow this?
Are they going to follow what's
going on? Are they really
going to
follow up what's going on?
Oh, they're amazingly
really?
Adept at following me.
Or resilient, I guess.
Yeah, they know. That there's little cues that I give them.
Okay.
Now they're back. Go ahead.
So we did...
It's 1983.
Yeah. Mythologies was three different essays by Roland Barthes.
But
Championship Wrestling.
But I want to say this. I want to say that the question was, how do two guys like you meet? Because now...
Okay.
The arts are all very segregated.
You're saying we're getting off the topic?
No.
Okay.
Not at all. I just wanted to make... All
right.
We're 100%. There's
so we were on... All I want to say is that one of these segments from the piece we did in the second year of the Next Wave Festival. The second year altogether. Like 84, 85. I'm not sure which one. But
Next
one
Wave,
of those. Yeah. That's what they're just... And, you know, at the time, you know, nobody lived in Brooklyn. I mean, you know.
No.
It was like, you know...
Yeah.
Your parents were, or your grandparents were struggling to get out of Brooklyn.
Yeah, it was like an immigrant's neighborhood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there was nothing near BAM. So everybody, the way you got to BAM was you took one of these shuttle buses from Lincoln Center, and then you disembarked in front of BAM, and it looked like the one building in Brooklyn. All around it looked like vacant lots and nothing. Yeah. There was just nothing there.
You know?
And you got this impression. Of course, it's ridiculous. There were things here. There were people living here and all that.
Right.
But... To the average Manhattan-centric person, arts kind of person, you'd go to BAM and you just thought, oh my God, Brooklyn is a little scary. There's nothing around here. Just BAM and then a wasteland. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, 100%.
So how do we meet? I met Mark at, there's a program called American Dance Festival. And in the summers, I guess they still do this, but they certainly used to have a big summer program at Duke University. And you simply applied for it. Composers and choreographers applied for it. And, you know, you had to be young and not have done too much. And then they just, they let all the choreographers listen to the tapes submitted by the composers, because they were at the time, they were, you know, cassette tapes.
Right.
And then they would choose somebody that they wanted to work with. And so Mark sort of chose me out of the blue.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What a stroke of luck.
Yeah.
That's great.
It's really cool. Yeah.
Well, that thing has to be going. What's that thing called again?
Yeah, it's called American Dance Festival. It's probably still in, it must be still in.
Maybe I can take advantage of my youthful poverty-stricken face and apply to them.
Yeah.
That would be great.
You should check it out.
And then I'm working with
the next Mark Morris. It's called something like, Young Choreographers and Composers in Residence, I think that's the program. Yeah.
I love it. At that point, so but going into it, you played piano growing up?
I was really bad. I hate to practice.
What about the parents? They play anything?
No. They sort of, they gave me piano lessons, but I never practiced. So at the time I showed up to college, I liked listening to music, but I couldn't play anything. And I went to college to be an English major. I wanted to be a writer.
Where was that, undergrad?
Yale.
Okay.
Yeah. And
so you worked hard. You got into Yale.
Yeah.
Where are you from one more time?
I was born in New York.
You're a New Yorker?
Yeah.
What neighborhood?
I was born on the Upper West Side.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Okay, so you didn't go. What?
No, but then I had like a gypsy existence.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I moved around a lot.
Upper West Side, are looking for making his way back to the Upper West Side.
Well, just a kid. But right. Eventually I made it.
Eventually,
back.
But you went to Yale.
Yeah.
All right. You went to Yale for English.
Well, I went to Yale for English, and I arrived at like the height of structuralism, and I freaking hated it. I'm allowed to say fucking hated it?
Yes.
Okay. Fucking hated it. It was
awesome.
Just horrible.
What is structuralism?
Don't ask. If you manage to avoid it, you're better off.
Okay.
It was just basically what it was I arrived at Yale.
It.
Well, yeah. I arrived at Yale idealistically loving to read books. And that was not a requirement for being an English major. In fact, it was not particularly desirable. Because what they wanted to do, structuralism, was how you take apart books and basically show that a crappy book is a little more interesting than a great book.
Right. Like they do with film majors, and they make them watch like Breakfast at Tiffany's and they analyze it for 7 days.
Yeah.
Chick flick.
Right. Well, and then the thing is that they I think that, all the people who teach it are that kind of thing. They've been teaching it for a long time. They've read everything. They're very jaded,
Right.
And so they literally would find like comic books.
Right.
And show us that because comic books, because the authors are less skilled, they're a more interesting display of, cultural norms than a great book.
That's what structuralism is.
Yeah, it's
so
part
it's
of
the
it.
Idea of getting away from the narrative and just looking at abstractions and structure and the way that those have affected the narrative.
That are almost against the author's will and all that. Yeah. I'd come back from my classes and I'd take the textbooks and fling them against the wall in desperation.
The thing I want to say about this, and this is something that you're bringing this to me, because we studied music. I studied music.
Yeah.
But I remember feeling that when you had to take your, art history course, you had to take, the history of acting courses or English.
Yeah.
As a musician and looking at how objective progress was,
right,
when you practiced or when you composed. Yeah. Versus the way that the other art forms sort of judged. Not really painting so much.
Right.
But more abstract things like English or whatever.
Right.
I guess. English.
No,
seems
I agree. And plus
but it seems like they kind of went, they were so far off that I was just like, this is just some guy talking now.
Yeah.
That's all this is. That's all I'm hearing a philosophical debate going on rather than an analytical.
And there's no place for consideration of beauty. There's nobody ever talks about that. Nobody ever talks about, God, I was, I got to this page and I was crying. It was so beautiful and moving.
It's all tongue in cheek. It's all about laughing.
Yeah.
It's all about laughing with them, with the English.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it can be that way. I have to say it can be a little bit in music too. you know, in universities.
Oh, 100%. What are you talking about? Yeah. Academic music? Yeah. I've been railing against it forever. Yeah. And that's, well, you're a very tonal composer, so yeah. that's why you're here.
Yeah. No, that's good.
I mean,
that's
I really good. Like tonal composers. Yeah. And I guess I'm sort of fighting for it a little bit more.
Yeah, as well you should. And you're fighting for it in your own work, too, which is excellent.
I can't believe you're saying that. That's a huge compliment.
No, it's absolutely just so, yeah.
Cool. Well, when you make money, I need... Throw some of it over.
Make
here.
Money? Wait a minute. Excuse me.
But as far as the so you were sitting there and you were dealing with like these people talking about how comic books, which comic books are kind of cool now.
Yeah, yeah.
They're pretty neat now.
I guess so.
They have.
I have a bad relationship with them because of
yeah,
this.
You're like I'm yeah. not doing that again.
Yeah, it's like bike riding. You know, when I was really really poor in Boston after grad school,
uh-huh.
you know, I couldn't pay for the insurance on my car. I had a uh-huh. car, but I couldn't pay for the insurance, so I just parked it in a friend's driveway, and I got like a terrible bike, like a Huffy bike at Kmart. And I used to pedal this bike to all the lessons that I would teach, you know, give kids music lessons
that's
and stuff.
Exactly what that is.
Yeah, but that's a nice bike.
No, that's Wendy's. Mine's one behind. That's nice.
That's a Huffy.
You
man.
Can see that's the
that's
real
like
deal.
A Huffy.
That's it's
like
just like
today's Huffy.
No, it's for real. No, it's for real, but it is good. Like, no, it does take the bike. Joy out of right. taking a Sunday bike ride because you immediately get your
right. And the thing is, if
I used to ride to the west side from the east side on that bike.
And if you're doing it for an underpaid job, that's a joyless task, you know, and right. it's raining and it's cold yeah. and all that kind of stuff.
I felt like a Viking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So for that reason, it took me many years to actually be able to enjoy bikes again.
And associate it with leisure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not with like,
or,
yeah.
Yeah. Or exercise or anything good like that.
Or dealing with a parent screaming at you that yeah. their kid's sick through an
So that's like comic books for me. Yeah, I know. Now they're called graphic novels. We're supposed to think of them
comic
all
books
differently.
For you are like bike riding if bike riding sucked.
That's right.
That's
well
what
said.
Say. We're starting to sound like your English professors. Yeah. But as far as that kind of drove you, the pure anger against
did,
the
actually.
Other mediums.
Well,
drove
then
you
I was desperate.
The objectivity of music.
And you know, I mean, I don't know if you agree with this, Brett, but it mm-hmm. seems to me like lots of times the biggest decisions you make in your life, you make for very, very short-sighted reasons, like just, I got to get out of here or something like that.
Yeah.
So in my case, it was just, I had to find something I could major in because I was going to go insane if I majored in English.
Oh.
And everything I had done up until that point was supposedly preparing me to major in English at Yale, which was like, you know, big
yeah.
fancy pants, great English. One
I can't
of the great
imagine
English
the pressure
department.
Of staying in that major.
No, it was impossible. I was mm-hmm. just going to. And I had spent the year before, by the way, before I even went to Yale, I spent a year on a kibbutz in Israel. Like straight out kibbutz, like farming from 5 a.m. till, you know, the afternoon. So
you understand, yeah.
And my parents had to basically beg me to come back to go to school at all. So I was not going to be sticking it out in some, you know, major that I hated. Some guy's classroom. And also, you know, I mean, Yale turned out to be a really good place for me, but overall, the social atmospheres can be a little hard to take. It's a little bit...
That's what I heard.
Yeah.
Yale's a huge music school. I mean, it was then. And
well,
I'm
thank
sure
God
it
was because it allowed me to find this completely other path.
Right, because Harvard is... No offense, but from what I understand, Harvard is the lineage of English. That's where, you know, I guess, what's the name? Longbottom went or whatever. Like all those guys. All the big American... Poets.
Longbottom.
Is that his name? What's
Long
his name?
Fellow?
Longfellow. I don't know about dance. I don't know about poetry.
No,
but some good comic books I can
E. Cummings went to freaking Harvard. That's enough, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
So there you go.
So Harvard has the more of that tradition.
Yeah.
And if you'd been there, it might have been a different story.
Maybe. But it doesn't have good music.
It has horrible music.
Yeah.
But the English...
Yeah, maybe.
Libretto. Without that, no Grammy.
Yeah.
Without studying this.
I worked my way back. It wasn't through.
But
it wasn't by virtue
gift.
Of anything.
You had a gift. You had a big enough gift to get you into Yale. We had a gift of writing, of the written word at your disposal.
Yeah, I guess. You did. I'm always comfortable. I mean, I love to read. I love to read.
Yeah.
Now I have no time to read, but I used to read voraciously.
I do too. Longbottom.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
E.K. Cummings.
And the other guy, right? Yeah. E.K.G. Cummings. Oh, man,
right.
He's great, yeah.
Exactly. Daniel Brown. Amazing. But as far as going...
Shake Sword. Oh, God. The greatest playwright ever.
So, everything is about just like knights of the round table. As far as getting into now making that transfer, how did your parents respond to that?
Oh, they were cool.
Look, cool parents. Cool, yeah, Upper West Side. The best.
Nah, not just that, but they're all artists. Everybody's. I come from a theater background.
Mm.
Yeah. And, oh. So that was the other thing. I guess that was the other kind of thing propelling me is a kind of appreciation for drama, and that, you know, obviously that still holds.
Right.
So when I probably it didn't feel that way to me at the time. I thought in terms of English and writing, I thought, oh, novels. I was like, you know, I was crazy about novels. I had read a lot at that point. But, you know, later on when I got back to writing, I think that my experience in theater had, you know, kind of resurfaced. And that's the kind of writing that I do. I don't write for, you know, I don't write short stories or anything else like that. It's always going to be performed.
Performed.
Yeah.
Right. It's going to be performed.
Yeah.
And that's where you feel like that's the line.
Yeah. I mean, that's what comes naturally to me. I sometimes say if
you visualize your things being said by a person.
Or sung. Yeah, right. Especially sung, but said too. Yeah, and I often say to myself, do you ever have those like morbid fantasies of like if you suddenly couldn't do music anymore, like if you went deaf or something like that?
Would you write a book?
What would you do? Yeah, I would definitely become a novelist.
You would?
Oh, yeah. That's what I would try to do. I would try. I certainly wouldn't write lyrics for some terrible other composer, because I couldn't hear his stuff.
Right. Yeah.
Right?
Like, if you went deaf.
I were deaf. Done. Like, no, I'm not going to trust you with my lyrics.
Moving over to the composition at Yale and stuff like that. Who'd you study with at Yale? Who was there?
Marty Bresnik was the guy at the time.
Yeah.
I didn't, he wasn't my private teacher, but I took plenty of classes with him, and yeah, he's very, you know, appealing composer and a really interesting thinker about music. But I didn't study with him privately. I studied with a really good composer, kind of unsung composer named Michael Friedman, but learned a lot from him.
What'd you learn from Michael?
I guess I learned...
And this is a time when everybody was writing sort of wacko music.
Yeah, well, it had to be... Nothing was tonal. Nothing.
Zero.
Was tonal.
Not until probably the late 90s, people started kind of slipping back into it.
Yeah, and even when I was in grad school, my composition professor at New England Conservatory was a strict serialist. Strict.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah. Well,
I remember people, like, I studied at Texas, and I remember Elliot Anacolitz, if you know who he is.
No.
He was a big Bartok scholar.
Okay.
And he would sit there, and he could improvise in tone rows.
Right.
And I was like, that must have been a different generation.
Yeah, I'm very sorry for you. You can improvise in tone rows.
Right. But that establishment is still there, and you see it in the Grammys. You see it in the nominations.
Yeah, you do.
You see it on the ballot.
You do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's definitely a home.
Yeah, and you see it in the culture at large, I guess. Mm-hmm. So at the time, you know, years later when I definitively moved over to tonal music, which was while I was still in grad school.
But that's okay. So that happens
pretty early for, you know, in terms of the culture as a whole.
No, that's very early, because most of the people don't really of the people that I've listened to, I mean, I'm just assuming their early works are pretty...
Yeah.
Well, that's not necessarily true.
Well, can I tell you a story about...
Please do.
I think this is an interesting story. I sometimes tell it... I guess I probably always tell it to my own composition students. I teach at NYU now.
I know you do.
And I liked my grad school composition teacher. I liked very much... you know, I liked some of his music. I liked him as a person very, very much. He was a good guy. But I always disagreed with his, you know, with serialism, and he always tried to get me to see the beauties of it, and certainly, I guess he liked the fact that you always knew what you were going to do next because you have that tone row to refer to, right?
Mm-hmm.
So one day I came in and I said to him, I'm kind of proud of myself in the aftermath for asking this question, because I guess either something like this had really happened to me or whatever. It just kind of crystallized.
No, you're a grad student too.
Yeah, yeah, you've thought
about
it.
It's time for you to ask questions.
So what I asked him was, let's say you've got you're in the middle of a piece you're writing with a tone row, you know. And the tone row is the is this you create this grid that gives you all the pitches you ever need to use in your piece. And you can, you know, you can go backwards through them, you can go forwards, up and down, but basically it tells you what you should do next. And as you know, as a composer, that's like one of the big challenges. What do I do next?
So that's the challenge.
That is the challenge.
Yeah.
So people who are serialists don't have that challenge so much, and it's an open question whether, you know, they're evading the real hard work of composing by having this thing to fall back on. So I said to him, what would you do if you're writing a serial piece, S-E-R-I-A-L, yep. And and you're, you know, you're well into the piece and you're everything is going well and you're sitting there at the piano, you're playing through a passage that you're composing, you're coming up with, and it's going well, and suddenly your hand slips, or one of your hands slips, and you play the most gorgeous chord you've ever heard. And you can't believe it. And you keep playing it over and over again. And it's perfect for that moment in your piece.
Yeah.
And it sounds absolutely glorious. And so you take out your pencil and you write down every note in that chord. And you check it again and again. It's like the most beautiful thing you've ever heard. And then you go back to your tone row. And no matter what you do, you cannot make that exact chord work at that moment in your piece because it doesn't conform to the pitches you're supposed to be at in your tone row. So I said to him, what would you do? Would you get rid of the chord or would you get rid of the tone row? And he said, I'd get rid of the chord. He said, I'd get rid of the chord. And I said, well, that's
lights
crazy.
Out.
Yeah, because I just said, there are not enough beautiful things in the world. I would never get rid of the
chord.
That's
amazing.
Never.
There aren't enough beautiful things in the world.
There are. There are plenty of systems in the world, but there are not enough beautiful things that you right. just happen on accidentally, right?
I mean, I feel bad because I talk about this a lot on the show, but you are, you know, you're an authority. You're an academic. You're sitting there at NYU. You know what you're doing. You know what you're talking
well,
about.
And
you have an opinion, and you're sticking by it.
Yeah, and I mean, hopefully this is a kind of a freeing opinion because it's not a particularly...
It's not a popular academic opinion.
No, it's not. And it's not really defensible from an academic point of view, but it's defensible from point of view.
When you did that to the teacher, was it a...
I wasn't being confrontational. I just said...
You said it, and in your mind, you went like, okay, well, then yeah, I'm going to get what I get out of this.
Yeah. And I had, at that point, I had tried...
It's not disrespect.
No.
It's just you got to trust your ear at a certain fucking point.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, There are composers who did very interesting things with tone rows, but to a limited extent. I think to a limited extent.
There's always that chord.
Yeah.
Like a Frank Martin who wrote a lot of guitar music and used...
Yeah,
and used,
he's a good composer.
But he broke... I mean, he had to.
Yeah.
Those chords in there. Some of those chords are just super gorgeous.
Yeah.
But and they're filled with suspensions that get resolved.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing is, as you know, and Copland, you know, towards the end of his life, he did some experiments with serialism and they were quite successful. Stravinsky did some that were really sound cool.
Yeah. It's a tool for exploration.
As a tool, it's fine. It's
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I have no problem. I don't do this, but if I ever did lack for something to do and I decided to explore a 12-note chord and then I decided that to use it in an integrated way by, you know, turning it upside down or breaking it up into three parts, I would have no problem in principle with that. It's just that once I turn my back on it, I don't feel the need for it. And one thing I don't seem to ever lack for ideas. I lack for time, but not ideas.
Now, yeah. So, and just to be clear, when people do listen to your music, let's just say the song that you sent me that we're going to play at the end, the Unicorn song.
Yeah.
That's not a 100% tonal piece by any definition.
Right.
There's plenty of forays.
Yeah.
Into the avant-garde in that piece.
Good.
But at the same time, there is a center. There is a tonal center.
There's a samba, too. And
there's
a straight-out samba,
Right. There's some showy.
Yeah.
There's some showy stuff going on in there.
And, yeah, it's true. I mean, I don't feel like... once I embrace tonality, I never ever felt constrained by it. And there is... I do think that there is a sort of onus on the tonal composer to always make your stuff sound fresh. But, you know, it's like the onus that's on a pop composer.
Yeah.
If you're a pop composer, you know, you don't have to reject 1 flat 7/4 But you do have the responsibility to make it fresh, you know.
Right.
I mean, unless you're totally craving and you just say, "No, man, I'm just looking for a hit here," and you know, fine, that's your choice. But otherwise, you know, you can use those same things all over and over and over again. But it is your responsibility to try to make it fresh, make it your own. And for me, I guess I am grateful that having started out at a time when straight out tonality was not really possible, you know, you just wouldn't get into a place like New England Conservatory if you wrote something that sounded just like Brahms, for example,
right.
You know. So it did in the early stages, as I was trying to figure out what it meant to be a composer, I did experiment with some very abstract stuff. And so it was good for your it's good for one's imagination.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and it's good also to just think critically about the creative process.
Yeah.
And it's good to think in codes. You know,
yeah,
or at least be able to.
But never, I could never be very systematic. That repels me. Just like, I tried because teachers told me early on, oh, you should try sketching out your whole piece before you start. And, you know, to be honest, I did try it a few times. And after whatever, I would maybe get this whole fantastic elaborate sketch. And then I would sit down to start to actually write the piece. And literally, like, by nothing. Second two, I would drop the sketch. And I'd lose it in a corner. It'd be covered in dust. I'd never think
about
it.
Yeah, the worst thing I ever wrote was a solo, like a sonata for guitar. And it was like three, okay, so it's going to be three movements.
Right.
Fast, slow, fast.
Right.
And it's going to have sonata form for the first movement. Right. And so I was like, okay, well, I'm going to do that.
Right.
And I'm going to try that. And it was just like, it had some good ideas in it, but it by no means was as powerful as the stuff I just started writing.
Of course.
Went to lunch, came back the next day, wrote more. Those are the best pieces.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's no art form.
And that's always the way I've interpreted music, too.
Yeah. Well, there's no art form in existence that doesn't rely on the unconscious.
Right.
It just doesn't. And so you have to, if it takes you having the most incredibly well-articulated, you know, system to be able to tap into your unconscious, well, I feel kind of sorry for you because you can actually just do it by just screwing around.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I agree.
And if you never tap into your unconscious, then I don't care how well formulated your system is. There's going to be nothing there. You know?
Well, I mean, and that's the thing is that, you know, when you're watching a performance or when you're listening to a composition, it is all about those moments. It's a moment. Mm-hmm. That's what you're looking for. Mm-hmm. Moment. Symphony of Psalms, Stravinsky.
Oh,
there's a moment.
Oh, God. So
there's a chord.
Moments. Yeah.
And, you know, that's like you were talking about, that chord, that moment. Those are moments. Those aren't sketched out. Those aren't planned.
No.
And they aren't seven chords. They aren't major seven chords.
Right.
They're seven chords with something from another chord that's still going on
right.
and then coming back down later.
Right.
Those are those moments that we, you know, that happen in Wagner or whatever. Those are those moments. Those
yeah.
are the moments of intense, you know, unadulterated artistic beauty.
I'm with you.
Those are those moments.
Yeah.
And when you're interpreting music, that's what I'm looking for. And the performer as well
mm-hmm.
is a smaller idea of the relationship between two notes as opposed to the arc of the phrase.
Right.
I mean, maybe it's just because I have a short attention span, but I usually
no, it's not. That's
give the... more of a shit about the cadence than the entire phrase.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Well, I mean, from my point of view, being somebody who comes from theater, and I confess I actually...
Yeah.
Early on, I was an actor, did a couple of little things, nothing, you know, just
right.
like theater stuff in New York and stuff.
Right.
But there, you know, you're absolutely lost if you're self-conscious and you're watching yourself and you're thinking about how you're going to deliver a line or, you know, anything like that, forget
yeah.
it. You're it's a non-starter, you know? So that might have been, you know, sort of the formative thing that.
But acting, that does give you a sense of an audience. It gives you a sense of getting audience, of genuine audience recognition, which you're
yeah.
saying, not just hitting them over the head with, you know, obsolete folklore and atonal
yeah.
music.
Yeah.
You get to see the joy of an audience being genuinely entertained as opposed to having their cultural night out for the, you know, year.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
I the thing that I guess I've always disliked about classical music And it's changing now. It's changing very much for the better. But the, you know, certainly it wasn't this. It was this way when I was coming of age. Is that is this sort of shakedown aspect? And you still get it a lot, which is that you, you pay a lot of money, you go to a fancy place, somebody fancy stands up in front of you, and you better damn well find it. You know,
you better find something
illuminating or somehow. And it's not, if it's not, then it, it then the onus is on you. It's like you're an idiot. You didn't see how. How great and important.
And we're here to tell you, as people that have been through the system, that you're not wrong.
No, you're not wrong. You're not wrong. You know, here's an interesting thing. Like, it's true of you know, other artists view, you know, new concert music this way too. Like, for example, I went, you know, years and years ago, I went a few times to the McDowell Colony, you know? And you'd be there with, like, people who were like,
I don't know what that
badass. It's like a, it's like artist summer camp. It, don't ask. It's so cool.
Don't ask.
No, don't ask. No. Well, I mean, you may you could go, but I can't go anymore.
It's way too cool.
It's you have to be way too single. I can't go. But it's you go for 4 to 6 to sometimes even 8 weeks, and they give you a cabin in the woods in New Hampshire, mm-hmm. and they bring you your meals, and you're just supposed to write. Yeah,
and like, have sex with each other.
There is that. Yeah.
Right.
You're not supposed to, but yeah, that's part of it. But anyway, so at these artist colonies, you know, you meet some absolute badass writers and painters. I mean, really, really good people.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, they split them up. There are some filmmakers, some composers, some writers, some painters, and everybody looks quizzically at the composers because they just they assume in advance, and they're usually right, they're not going to understand anything of what the composers are doing there, you know, and they don't trust themselves. I mean, you people like, you know, I mean, I was at one time I was at McDowell with E.L. Doctorow, you know, incredible writer, right? And even he would, a composer would give a presentation of some of his or her work, and he would say to me afterwards, well, I didn't really get it, but I guess it's just because I'm not smart enough. I said, what, you're freaking E.L. Doctorow, you're smart enough. You know.
Right.
You actually know. You just don't trust your own reaction. You just don't trust yourself because you think, because of this big, huge shakedown around music, like, you know.
Right.
Look at the New York Times, any review of classical music in the New York Times, and it's a huge shakedown time, you know.
Right. I just go, like, I don't even know what they're talking about 90% of the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But you're right. The theater is like the opposite of that because you just can't get away with that at all.
You can't
people
get away
have
with
to
it.
Be, yeah,
they, and when they people are over, and it's not about not being smart. It's no, it's not. It's just about not being entertaining.
Yeah,
at all. Like not being an entertaining person.
Yeah,
you know. And that's, I think that that's part of the big issue, is that all these people who are good musicians or good composers, have a skill, have a great ability to orchestrate, you know, and they find great combinations of instruments and stuff like that. That does happen.
Right.
And that happens a lot in atonal music. Like that's kind of, that's their bread and butter. It's like orchestration, sometimes form, sometimes I guess. I don't know.
Who listens to form?
I don't know. You know.
So, I mean, the thing is, I'm writing and you're writing for a real audience of people, not an expert audience, you know? And I tell my students,
well, then they whine
the
about what's going on with classical music. Oh, wham. Well, what's happening is you aren't, there's no entertainment.
Yeah, but also if you're that person writing that piece, you have to understand how an audience hears music. I mean, my God, think about how the average person, I mean, a smart person, cultured person, well-read person, alert person, somebody you'd like and who you'd like to have like your stuff. Right. Think about how they hear music. They don't hear harmony. They don't hear form. They hear anything. If they're words, they tend to hear words, and the music is just this kind of magic coloration of the words, right? And there's nothing wrong with that. You have to respect that.
Right.
You know, don't do little tricks in your music that are completely, you know, obscure, and nobody's going to hear, and it's not going to affect anybody's experience of the piece.
It's a waste. It's just a waste of resources.
Yeah.
Anyway.
All right, we got that settled. Good. Next.
But so, you know, what's going on with you now? We're kind of coming to the end here.
Okay.
But what's, I mean, you got this album is from how recently?
This is from last year. Yeah, New Voices by a great outfit here in Brooklyn called the Brooklyn Art Song Society. And they do something like 12, I don't know, sometimes more than that, concerts a year. And one series of concerts that they do in this every spring, they call New Voices, and it's always new new composers, but always you have to be able to write for the voice to do this. They're not going to take you if you're writing that. You
know, yeah, I have no idea.
Squeak fart stuff for the voice. So it's a really nice, good bunch of composers and some excellent singers. And this was their first album that they put out last year.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's really it's
pretty cool.
Good looking album.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And so I am you know, I've been writing vocal music and theater music of various kinds for quite some time now, and that's I can't see stopping. So I have like a, you know, I wrote a song cycle that was done at Barge Music like 3 months ago, mm-hmm. And I have a new song cycle that's ready to go that some really great performers are just starting to rehearse now, and I have this long ongoing collaboration with my friend Bob Aldridge, who is the composer of Elmore Gantry, and we finally have our follow up.
Elmore Gantry. Right.
Was the opera we wrote together that won two Grammy Awards, and right. it's out on disc on Naxos. Mm-hmm. And it was premiered in 2008, and then it's taken till now for us to write our follow up opera, which is also based on a classic American novel called Sister Carrie by Theodore Dreiser, like a great, very gritty. He was a very progressive socialist, you know, thinker of his time, and usually took on very gritty urban subjects of this, which this is one. It's called Sister Carrie, but it's nothing to do with nuns. Very important. Mm-hmm. It did not have anything to do with nuns. So anyway, we have our follow-up in October. It's premiering at Florentine Opera of Milwaukee, and we're really proud of that. It's a very big scale grand opera, but it's pretty cool.
The two of you working together so much, how did you guys come in contact?
We were just pals in Boston.
Boston.
Yeah.
New England.
Yeah. We both went there slightly different times. And then we were just freelancers in Boston doing our thing. And we became friends as composers. And then, you know, we just kind of embarked on Elmore Gantry. I mean, it took a long, long time to get it produced. A long time. It's like there was this huge...
I can't imagine producing an opera.
Well, we really ran into some bad luck. Not just bad luck, but we were incredibly arrogant, you know. Mm-hmm. We would say with good reason, but because we really worked hard on this thing. We really thought we'd done an important American piece of work there. And
yes,
and
you're entitled to say that.
Yeah. Anyway, so nobody would produce it for a long time. It took us 17 years to get the thing produced. And then when it finally was, then it went on, you know, in pretty short order to do very well for itself, which was gratifying.
That's incredibly good information for my audience to hear.
Yeah, well, here's another thing is that I always say to myself that the turning point of that opera, what happened was we developed it and we did very complete workshops of it that I directed actually in Boston in around 92, and then it lay dormant until it was premiered in
2008.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And God, damn, that's a long time.
But here's the interesting thing. For those of you who might be listening who are, you know, who are composers who are doing kind of crazy mad projects.
My friends are just, I mean, they're just it's
and you doubt yourself and you wake up and you want to
one of the best composers I know, Morton Gould Winner. I went to school with him. I love him so much. Yeah. Tony Landman. He works at Guitar Center.
Oh, Jesus. Of all the places.
He's got a doctorate.
Oh, man. Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, I mean, Jesus, guitar. Better work at the Cold
Stone
Creamery over across the way. A bunch of 13-year-olds
practicing their
pentatonic
scales. Yeah, it's just a nightmare.
Wow. Wow. And getting them wrong, too. Anyway, but the best thing, you know, the best thing about the whole process, we went through some really, really dark times with that piece because, you know, we thought we really believed in it, but no one would produce it. One of the best things about that period was when we finally decided, like, look, we really love this piece, you know, we would sing it to each other and all this kind of stuff.
Oh,
but
Jesus.
We thought, no one is ever going to do this during our lifetimes, but we have to make sure we don't put it away on the shelf with things we're unhappy with. So we went back and we did like a whole set of revisions just to perfect it in the knowledge that it would never be done. But we wanted it to be as good as we could possibly make it. So that was really important. I don't know why, in terms of just karma or our own attitude towards it. But once we got to that point, then...
You started doing it again.
Yeah, and things started started slowly, slowly happening.
And do you think it started happening
because... Which is to give up. You have to give up. You're like you know, you there's some really good composers who have given up, like Lou Harrison. Like, the guy just gave... He moved from New York. He was moving to Washington State or wherever it was he lived. He said, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm not going to go through all those disappointments and stuff. You know, fuck the world. I'm just going to do my stuff.
Yeah, I'm about there right now. For sure. Yeah. But then when you do that... do you think that the reason that it worked out, you know, commercially successful wise, for that opera was, because you had gotten older and you had more contacts? What do you think?
It was a political situation. It was blind luck. And it was the fact that it was an entirely, not just tonal opera, but an entirely tonal number opera, meaning no bullshit, no recitatives. It was all like number, you know, duet. Ensemble, and it was very much based on.
You call it number opera. You mean like the number is an aria, or
yeah,
what? Okay,
yeah,
right.
Which is you know, nowadays people are sort of sidling back to that idea, but not fully. But at the time, nobody did that. I mean, Stravinsky had the Rake's Progress, but it was, you know, thought to be basically a failure because of that fact. Mm-hmm. Nobody was writing in 92 or whatever. Nobody was writing a number opera. It still is more of a number opera than anything you'll hear these days. So anyway, it was a combination of that and it's you know, absolutely unashamed embrace of tonality. But like not like dumb tonality, like interesting tonality. So that definitely held it back too. I mean, look.
That held it back.
There's a famous critic who now writes for a very famous publication who at the time was writing for a newspaper in Boston, and he absolutely killed it. He absolutely killed it in 92. He just said it was like treacle, and he compared it unfavorably to Leonard Cohen, because at the time, you know, nobody thought anything of Leonard Cohen. And then when we did it many years later, we did a little workshop of it in New York. He turned around and gave it a good review. So that's what 15 years had done. The same critic gave it a very good review.
Whoa. Yeah. Okay. See,
so that means something, yeah.
Well, I like... Well, that's a good direction we're going in.
Yeah, yeah.
Man, you're there at the helm, maybe. Sir.
Herschel, I'm in steerage, man.
That's right. Well, thanks so much for joining me, Herschel. I really appreciate it. This is a pleasure. Absolutely.
I lost track. I don't know if we ever actually said anything interesting.
Well, this is about... Fun, we talked for about 3.5 hours.
Yeah, great.
And we're neighbors. Yeah. Where do you live in Brooklyn?
In Park Slope.
All right. Yeah. Well, I'll go down there. I'll take my stroller and sit in it.
And I want to come check out your ensemble when you're playing, too.
Yeah. Absolutely. That would be a huge honor.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks so much for joining
us. My pleasure. Thank you.
All right, guys. This is the Brooklyn Art Song Society's recording of Herschel's piece, The Unicorn. I will be back next time with Khalil. What's his whole name? I'm sorry. I know him personally. Rafiq Kaya. And I'm sorry about the quality here. I'm just recording it onto the computer's speakers. I don't have my microphones with me. I will explain all of this in due time, but hang in there. We'll be back next time with Khalil, hopefully, if he's got time to talk. And if not, I'll see you guys a little bit later. I'm trying to get David Russell on the show, so his wife and I are trying to make it work. All right, so I'll see you guys next time. Thanks for listening. There are precedents for mystical encounters. Or to be less extreme, a choice of persuasions to put it down to fancy. Until my God says a second man, I must be dreaming. I thought I saw a unicorn cross my path. Now there is a maximum of tension. The implications are alarming. A third witness can add no new dimension.
get some music.